opinions expressed here are the views of the speaker, not necessarily those of their hosts, producers, or owners.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to Socialist Can, 1 hour left. We come on every week at this time, and we share information from various guests and also from our panel in regards to various viewpoints of what is taking place in this country and also the world, and we do it from a socialist point of view. Today we have a very special program lined up for you. We had Howie Hawkins. He is the 2020 candidate for president, and he's running as a candidate on the left, and we're very pleased to have him joining our program today. And on our program, we will be discussing how will his campaign benefit working people and building a national labor party. And Howie, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining the program.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Howie, this is the first time that you have run as a candidate for president. Is that correct?
Yes. I was on the ballot as a stand-in on petitions for Ralph Nader and Jill Stein a couple times, but that was just for the petitioning, not for the – I didn't run.
Was that in 2008, or what year was that, 2000, the year 2000 when?
I think I did it in 2004 and 2008 for Nader, maybe 2000. And I did it.
Oh, I see.
And Jill, I did it, I think, both in 2012 and 2016 as a vice presidential candidate. And in Nader's case, I was standing in because he hadn't announced yet, and we had to get some petitions in. He always waited till late.
Right. And one day I'll tell you about how he was able to get on the ticket with the Peace and Freedom Party, but we'll discuss that not on the show today. Howie, just recently, the total non-farm payroll employment rose by 130,000 in August, and the unemployment rate was unchanged at 3.7%, and that's according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor reports. I want to ask you, Howard, how accurate are these numbers, and does this 3.7 represent the real rate of unemployment among working people?
Well, the number they report, I think, is pretty accurate, but you got to know what they're reporting. They're reporting what they call the officially unemployed, which are people who are actively looking. And the way they get these numbers is the U.S. Census Bureau has an ongoing American Community Survey that does scientific samples between censuses. And so they report on a regular basis, on a monthly basis for the unemployment statistics. So that's what the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses. And that's called They have six measures of unemployment that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out. That's U3. But there's a more expansive measure that they use. It's called U6. And that's the officially unemployed plus the involuntary part-time workers. Those are people part-time want to work full-time, plus what they call marginally attached. Those are discouraged workers that have been looking, but in the 4 weeks before the survey asked them, they weren't. So that gets you to 7.2%. But I think that isn't a good measure of the marginally attached. There's a group called the National Jobs for All Coalition, which does its own measure every month. And they use the same statistics, but they have a broader definition of those who are looking for work but not counted. And when you add them in, you get 9.2% of the labor force, which is 15.6 million people. So I think that's a better measure of the real state of unemployment. About 1 in 10 people want a full-time job and they can't get it.
About how many?
1 in 10.
1 in 10. So that's
right.
around 34 million people. Well, when you consider working people, not children, we're talking about around 20 million people. Is that correct?
15.6 is what the National Jobs for All Coalition gets. So they don't count people who have left the labor force, which has increased in recent years since the Great Recession. And some of those people were just totally discouraged and felt they'd never get another job. Others are people who retired early, seemed a better choice to get on Social Security early than to try to work in a very marginal position in the job market. So they've been sort of pushed out of the labor market. So you can start counting those people and get more.
Well, would you not consider them unemployed?
Well, it depends on how you want to define unemployed.
If you push me out of a door and I want to be inside the room, I feel like I'm being excluded. So, I mean, should those people be, you know, included as the people that want to be employed?
They can be. The question is how you count them. Because
right. Okay. How they count them.
You know,
them.
If you've
okay.
been 5 years retired and you're 65, you know, you're getting your Social Security. You know, if a job came up, you might take it, but you're not out there looking. That's the situation
looking.
For a lot of people.
Right. One of the things I was looking at was the breakdown that was presented by the Atlantic Federal Reserve, and it gave a breakdown of 95 million Americans who weren't working, according to the latest figures that they've reported, which was conducted based on figures that they had, and they had 94.6 million people were of the age that were above the age of 16. Were out of the workforce, and of those, 44.5 million were retired, 14.5 million were in school or job training, 12.8 million were taking care of loved ones, 15.3 million weren't working because of illness or disability, and I find myself I just recently retired from the automobile industry, and I found that a lot of people that were retired, even though they were retired, they still wanted some type of part-time work. They, in most cases, they said that they just could not find it. They were looking for work to supplement their income. So when we look at the numbers, is it not fair to include the people that would really like to work, even if it's part-time or to supplement the income? I would say as working people, they are still unemployed. They're part of the working class, and they're unemployed. Is that a fair statement, Howie?
I think for a lot of them it is. I'm not sure it is for all those. How many total was that, like 90 million?
94.6 million.
Yeah. Well, like the people in school, I didn't write down the numbers, but there's, you know, millions of them. They will be coming into the workforce, most of them. And the people taking care of family members, you know, they might like to be able to do a job instead of take care of their people and have somebody come in and take care of their family member. We should have a medical system like taking care of the elderly that has long-term care included in the benefits, which Medicare doesn't do. So, I mean, basically you have to go broke and Medicaid will do it for you. So
right.
You have to spend all your assets until you're poor, and then Medicaid will, you know, send somebody in to take care of you. So, yeah, you can expand that. It's, you know, really a matter of how you want to define the unemployed. The number from the National Jobs for All Coalition is, I think, the best measure I've seen of those who really want to work. They're ready to go now. They're not in school. They're not doing something else. They want to work, but they can't. So
right.
But you're right. If jobs were plentiful,
yeah.
A lot of these people that are in those other numbers you gave me would take jobs.
Right. And I find that many college students, they like to have some type of supplemental income, even if it's working in a juice shop or working in some type of clothing store where they can work a few hours to help to supplement, give them some supplemental income. Obviously, they're not looking at working full-time because they have studies. But as I mentioned, we need to look – if people want to work, I think work should be made available. But anyway, let me move on, Howard – how the current federal minimum wage is $7.25 per hour and has not increased since July 2009. We're talking about a whole decade. What should the minimum federal rate per hour nationally, what should it be, and what do you propose Congress should do to be doing something about the minimum wage standards for working people? Howie?
Well, I would build into the minimum wage, I'd index it to inflation and productivity. And that way you wouldn't have to get a new minimum wage bill through Congress. I mean, now it's been a decade, and $7.25
an hour. So
where
do we, if you say index it, do we index it starting from $7.25 an hour?
No, my proposal is to index it for $20 an hour minimum wage in 2020 dollars. So 20 by 20, and then you index that to
20
inflation
by 20.
And productivity. Yeah, and then you index that to inflation and productivity. Because what's been happening is, you know, they haven't raised the minimum wage in a decade, and of course the cost of living has gone up, but also productivity's gone up. And if you look at the relationship of wages to productivity, there was a period between World War II and the early 1970s when wages increased at the same rate as productivity. Productivity measures how much we're producing per hour of work. And then about 1973, wages flattened. In fact, they've gone down a little bit, and productivity's kept going up. So we're creating more value with our labor, but we're not getting the reward. So that's why I want the minimum wage indexed to inflation and productivity.
Well, when I look at these numbers I've seen over the last decades, we have had more billionaires created in the last decade than we have had in the last five decades. When you look at the numbers of how those numbers have increased exponentially. So when you look at what has taken place on Wall Street executives and the CEOs and the people that are benefiting from the profits, the ones I see that are not benefiting are the workers. Now, what is the minimum wage there in New York where you reside? The state minimum wage.
Yeah, it went up to, I know it was $10.40 upstate. We have different wages in different parts of the state. See, I campaigned on a $15 minimum wage in 2010 and 2014, and when I got 5% of the vote in 2014, that was one of the concessions Governor Cuomo made. So the state is on a schedule to get to $15. They're at $15 in the city of New York, and then the suburbs of New York are on a slower schedule, and upstate we're on a snail's pace schedule. We get to $12.50 in 2021. Then they're going to look at how long it should take us to get to $15. So I was, because my pension was cut, the consolation prize, I could go back to work at UPS. But I go back with losing my seniority. So I go back at the starting wage, which is the state minimum wage, which was $10.40 an hour, end of last year. It went up some since then. I don't have the number in my head. But, New York is higher than a lot of places. You know, I was driving through Tennessee in the campaign and stopped at a Waffle House about 2 a.m. and talked to this young woman. And, you know, she said she didn't vote. And I talked about what we were talking about. And she said she might vote for that. And we got to talking about wages. She looked at the palm card, $20 hour minimum wage. She said, damn. My minimum wage is $2.13. That's the federal tipped minimum wage. Now, her employer is supposed to top her up to $7.25 an hour if she doesn't get it. But a lot of these employers don't do that. It's called wage theft, and it's a big problem. It's billions of dollars. That's how you get billionaires. You exploit people and steal their labor. And then in the Great Recession and the aftermath, we stole their damn homes. You know what the predatory bankers did with the subprime loans that got people underwater, and then they wouldn't give them mortgage relief, you know, rewrite the mortgage down to the new market value, and the federal government was willing to pay the difference, but then the Obama administration only spent $15 of the $75 billion set aside for that, And then they did the robo-signing, you know, where they basically made up the documents and stole people's homes. Now, the guy that was in the middle of that had only mortgage servicing companies is Wilbur Ross. He's head of the Commerce Department. And one of the biggest predatory lenders and foreclosers was Steve Mnuchin, who runs the Treasury Department.
Right.
So because the Obama administration wouldn't prosecute these banksters, they're now running the government. In that way, the Democrats, you know, one of my arguments is you may beat Trump in this election, but you're not going to beat Trumpism because you don't know how to fight the right. In fact, you're complicit with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's the kind of reason we have billionaires and we have people making $2.13 an hour, you know, and at 2 a.m., her shift is the graveyard shift. There are not a lot of people coming through in the middle of the night giving her tips. So she's trying to live on that down there in Tennessee. So, you know, that's the kind of situation at the bottom of the labor market we got. You know, we have basically, you know, half the population are working poor. They can't pay rent, utilities, let alone, God forbid, a medical bill, groceries. They got to skimp on something every month. And that puts a lot of stress on them. And we got a situation now where we have a 20-year wage life expectancy gap between people in our poorest counties and people in our richest counties. And that's inexcusable and immoral. And raising the minimum wage is the quickest, fastest way to make sure those hardworking people that's hardly getting paid get enough so that they can live a decent life and pay their bills. So the minimum wage has got to come up. We were calling for 15 a decade ago. Now we're calling for 20 by 20.
Well, I've been pushing for 16. I like your number a little bit better than the numbers that I've been talking about. Howie, we have listened to presidential candidates in regards to creating good paying jobs. Yeah, corporate America want the benefits of cheap labor for industrial and manufacturing jobs. So either way you look at it, they just want cheap labor. What can be done to create good-paying manufacturing jobs? I'm not talking about jobs working in burger shops. I'm not saying anything's wrong with working in a burger shop. Jobs where you're working in a Mervyn's or working in as a clerk in a grocery store. But good-paying manufacturing jobs, what can be done to create those good jobs?
Well, if we're talking about good-paying manufacturing jobs, the first thing we got to do is rebuild manufacturing in this country. It's largely been offshored to these cheap labor markets, Mexico, China, and other parts of the world. And we've let it, you know, we talk about, you know, building solar and wind. We got to go to China or Germany to import the panels and the windmills. So, you know, I've been calling for an eco-socialist Green New Deal. And the centerpiece of that program is the federal government should build zero-waste, clean-powered manufacturing facilities. So that's we need that to build this clean energy system, solar, wind, railroads, electric heat pumps, the smart grid for the distributed nature of renewable energy, an interstate universal internet system. There's a lot of things we need to build. We don't have much of a machine tool industry left. And those are the machines, or that's the industry that builds the machinery for intermediate goods and consumer goods. So we got to start there and then build these sectors back out. And
well,
I want to keep them as...
How do you prevent... Those are good jobs, but how do you prevent the ones that are in the boardroom and they get the direction that the politicians want to go in regards to creating these good... clean jobs? How do you make certain that those corporate executives say, okay, we're going to run with these green jobs, and now we see those jobs end up, the manufacturing still end up in Indonesia or in Taiwan or in China or India? How do you prevent that?
We get rid of those useless executives and we own our own jobs. And these factories I'm talking about as we're building the Green New Deal should be public enterprises, either public utilities, publicly administered like power utilities and the railroad system, or the factory should be leased to worker co-ops. And in a worker co-op, of course, the workers get their full value of the labor. They get the full fruit of the labor they create. And you have a fair distribution of income to begin with. But the key thing is we change who owns them so that we won't move our jobs. We won't move ourselves and our jobs to Indonesia so we can pay ourselves less. We just won't do that. So that's the first thing. You want to raise wages? We need labor law reform. We have these right-to-work states. We have Taft-Hartley provisions and some other federal laws that outlaw or severely restrict labor's basic organizing tools, like solidarity strikes and boycotts and pickets and political action. So we need labor law reform. We need majority card check union recognition, which, of course, Obama promised, and then he promised twice, actually, in 2012 and 2008 and 2012 campaigns, and then did nothing about pushing Congress to do it, and Congress is already compromising right out the gate. People like Harkin out of Iowa, who is supposed to be this big populist. Another law we need is a just cause for termination. They have it in Montana. They have it in most European countries, and what that means is you can only be fired for economic reasons. You can't be fired for capricious and arbitrary reasons.
So that gets rid of right to work.
Well, no, right to work is that you can't have a union shop.
I mean, here in California, right to work, they don't need a reason to terminate you.
Right.
And also, they can still have a shop without it being a union. But right to work is, basically, if they, an employer, wish to terminate your employment, and same thing in Texas, they can terminate your employment because you don't have that right for employment, and people should have a right for gainful employment.
Well, I'm for the right to a job, and if you can't get in the private sector, the government should provide a job for you in public service or public works. The just cause provision prevents arbitrary firings. They have to have an economic reason. They can't just say, we're getting rid of you and we're going to pick somebody else off the street or my cousin. And then,
that's different. And I agree with you there.
Yeah. And then the right to work laws say that you can't have a closed shop. When you negotiate a contract with the employer, everybody, you can't have a clause in that contract that says if you're going to work there, you got to be a member of the union and pay dues. Like UPS has a national contract, but in a right-to-work state, they don't do the dues checkoff. So, a worker has to opt in to the union and their dues. And so a lot of them don't, and they free ride. So, that's a law. We need federal legislation to just say you can't do that. And the third thing I would say is we need fair trade agreements. Right now, these corporate-managed trade agreements, they have these secretive trade tribunals, and they use them to knock down national regulations, public enterprises, and public services. And what we need are fair trade agreements that raise up labor and environmental standards across borders. We should be in solidarity across borders. We should have trade agreements that lift up the wages in Mexico, China, and Indonesia, or have a tariff where if you're exploiting cheap labor, you pay a tariff to get into our market, then we use that tariff revenue to help the labor movement in those countries. And then
when you put a tariff, where does the money from the tariff, where does it go to? Who pays for that tariff? I mean, who pays for it ultimately?
Well, the consumer ultimately pays for it, but the companies, they won't pay for it if it's domestically produced. If it's imported, the company that imported has to pay it initially, and then that revenue can be used to support labor organizing unions in the country where they were importing from, so they can organize to raise their wages. So it's called social tariffs.
Because traditionally we see with tariffs, the owners always pass the cost of those tariffs on to consumers. In other words, they just pay higher prices for those goods that they purchase.
Well,
so,
they try to. They always can't do that. If there's competition from other people selling cheaper, they got to come down to that price or they won't be able to sell their product.
Well, it depends on what markets it's coming from, too.
That's right. And that's
right.
Why we need, for example, in manufacturing, rebuild our manufacturing base so that the monopolies, I mean, right now we got global oligopolies, you know, a few big firms, and they're setting the terms, and they're playing workers here off against workers in other countries, and it's a race to the bottom. And that's why we need new fair trade agreements, and we need a domestic manufacturing industry. That's publicly owned, socially owned, so that
the corporate boards aren't
making the decisions.
What you were saying about factories and industry where it's going to be owned by the workers, it's going to be, the jobs going to be created for the workers, the factories will be run by the workers, the profits, they're going to actually benefit from profits from that. But how are we going to make this turnaround with this two corporate party system that we have right now in Washington?
Well, we have to elect eco-socialist Greens and socialists. You know, we need an independent left political party that's based in the working class, a labor party.
I love that.
Yeah. But I would say it has to be based on the workers, not institutionally on the unions. You know, that some of the labor parties, like in England, the unions were a conservative force. It was the constituency parties. You know, they had three sections. Each had about a third of the vote. There was the parliamentarians, there was the unions, and there was the constituent labor parties. The constituent labor parties, the rank-and-file labor members, were always more radical than the unions and the parliamentarians, who were about cutting deals and protecting their own privileges. So I think it's more democratic. It has to be based in the working class. It should be supported by the unions, but the unions shouldn't have direct institutional power. You know, in other words, you shouldn't have Jimmy Hoffa representing me as a Teamster deciding how my votes are going to be cast in a labor party. I should be able to go there as a worker and, you know, elect my representative or be a delegate myself. You see what I'm saying? So,
and that's when I was in the Teamsters, that's what I did not like. You know, I didn't feel like I was representing myself. I had the bosses of the union. They were controlling my vote. And they were saying, well, this is what we're going to do with your vote.
Right. You don't want a block vote cast on our behalf by some union leaders or union bosses. The workers themselves should have, you know, the right to determine their own positions and vote for themselves.
Just before we take a break, back in the 60s and 70s, good-paying jobs were first offered to whites in society. How do we deal with discrimination in employment in the 21st century? Because let me give you a heads up. Discrimination is still there in employment. All you have to do is just go to downtown Los Angeles or Riverside or go to Oakland, and you can see a lot of people. It's not because that they don't want work. You know, as soon as they go and put in the application, whether it's online or in person, you know, the application goes no further. But how do we deal with that in the 21st century?
And you even see it when you go to work, because the discrimination continues on the job with respect to advancement, treatment, and so forth. Well, the first thing is, you know, blacks and other minorities need to organize to fight for their rights, and the role of Greens and socialists is to help them do that. That's the first thing. The second thing is we have laws on the books, anti-discrimination laws, and they have not been enforced. You know, for example, they've been, you know, there are fewer and fewer cases as we come down the years. Clinton brought fewer cases than George H.W. Bush, and then George W. Bush brought less than Clinton. Now, Obama kicked it up a little bit. Now, with Trump, it's way down. They're just not enforcing anti-discrimination laws. And then the affirmative action programs put in by Nixon, they weren't radical programs. They were to help blacks and other minorities get access to apprenticeships and other educational and job training programs so they had an equal opportunity. And that got disparaged as, quote-unquote, reverse discrimination. And, you know, it really went out in the 1980s. The Democrats and the Republicans decided instead of desegregation, anti-discrimination, they were going to do gimmicks like charter schools. and call that the new civil rights movement, which was just a money-making scam. And then the other thing we got to push for, we were talking about it before, is full employment. Because one of the things, you know, seniority in union contracts is a good thing because it rewards long-term employment and secures your position in the firm, in the contract, and the union protects you on that. But the problem is, because of discrimination, blacks tend to be the last hired and the first fired when they're layoffs because of those seniority rules. But, you know, employment should not be rationed. So everybody willing and able to work should have a job with the government as employer of last resort. And that way, everybody will have work. And the discrimination where you favor one group over another won't even be necessary or won't even be possible.
Howie, I'm going to take a very quick pause here. I'd just like to mention to our listeners that they are tuned into Socialist Can. 1 hour left. We have a special program today. We have 2020 presidential candidate Howie Hawkins. He's joining the program today. We're discussing how will his campaign benefit the working class and building a national labor party. Howie, I'd like for you just to take a couple minutes just to express to our listeners what is going on with your campaign and also how they can be able to get involved with your campaign as well. Howie?
Sure. The main goal of my campaign is to build the Green Party as an independent eco-socialist party on the left. So we're going for ballot lines. We're trying to get on all 51 ballots. That includes the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C. And then we're helping our Greens learn how to be organizers, not just activists. So Greens are good at showing up, but they're not so good at organizing and building, you know, broad-based, ongoing organizations. So it's a party-building exercise. And, you know, people say, well, why do you run for president? Why don't you start locally? You got to get ballot lines in order to run those local candidates. So that's what this is about. And then in terms of the issues we're raising, my theme is an eco-socialist Green New Deal. We got to get to 100% clean energy and zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. So we have a massive investment program to build out this green economy. And then inequality, as I was talking about earlier, kills. So we're calling for an economic bill of rights. This is part of the Green New Deal. Everybody should have the right to a job, an income above poverty, a decent home, comprehensive health care, a good education, and a secure retirement. And we have programs to make sure the government provides for that. And then the third big issue, these are the life and death issues at the top of the agenda, is the new nuclear arms race. I mean, we're getting out of these arms treaties. All the nuclear powers are developing new nuclear weapons, and they're on hair trigger alert. And I'm calling for take them off hair trigger alert, pledge no first use, unilaterally disarm to a minimum credible deterrent. And after we make that gesture, go to the nuclear powers and say it's time to abolish nuclear weapons, like 122 nations did with the just adopted treaty they agreed on the wording in 2017, Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. That has to be a high priority, or otherwise we may not be here very much longer. So now, to get a hold of the campaign and you know, find out how to get involved, donate, volunteer, and just find out what we're talking about, go to howiehawkins.us. That's the website. Just put that in the Google machine, and you'll come up with our website, and you can take it from there.
Whose idea was H2O? I like that.
Some young person who I haven't met, but the campaign manager, you know, graphic artist. Yeah, I'm HH. It's 2020, so they just shortened it to H2O. And people like it. I got an H2O button. The only problem is sometimes, like, I showed up at a Motel 6 where they had to put me up one night, and they said, oh, you're from the water department. And they started telling me about all their problems.
H2O. That's a good one. Howie, again, I really appreciate you joining the program. Howie, how do you address discrimination in employment against women? I mean, it's a big, big problem today. Women, I mean, one of the largest minority groups out there, and of male and female, they're the dominant, but we see vast discrimination against women of all colors. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, it's where women have to work 15 months to get what a man gets in 12 months on average. And I think it's the same basic approach I was talking about before. Women have to organize, and Greens and Social should be helping them do this, to fight for their rights. We need to enforce anti-discrimination laws. They're already there. They need to be enforced. Restore affirmative action. And we need full employment. And the there is a bill that passed the House in March. It's called the Paycheck Fairness Act. It's H.R. 7. And it would add strength to the anti-discrimination laws because it would prohibit employers from asking job applicants about their salary history, which discriminates against women. You know, they find out the women's getting paid less, so they think they can get away with paying them less going forward. And then it would also require employers to prove that any disparities in pay between men and women are job-related. In other words, you'd have to say it's not work of comparable worth and prove that. So that would give women another tool in the anti-discrimination laws to get fair treatment.
So how do we obviously that's it's going to be a long approach, a short approach. I had a doctor, I was listening to a doctor on television, this was yesterday, and she was saying when she was interviewing for a position at some medical institution, and one of the things when she was in the interview, that one of the questions came up was, why did she feel that she should be asking for that type of pay when that was the pay that most doctors or physicians in that field were making? And we find that most women are making 85% for the same job as a male,
right? Right.
85% the same salary. So,
and it's illegal. You know, where the hell is the government? Where's the Justice
totally
Department?
Illegal.
Where are the DAs? Where are the attorney generals? You know, they're asleep on a job because they're answering to the corporations and not to the people. And these two parties we got in government, they're not taking care of the people.
So, again, I mean, I don't mean to dwell on this, but how should we as a society make sure that women receive equal pay for equal work? Should we start throwing in jail these attorney generals, you know, these state executives that are not implementing the law? I mean, where do we start? Because
well,
the laws are already on the books.
Right. I would throw the bums out. They don't have to go to jail. They're just not doing their
throw
job.
Throw the bums
you know,
out.
We got to
like
fire
that.
Them. We need to put new people in there. Now, some of the corporate executives that are, you know, persistent, repetitive discriminators, yeah, they maybe should go to jail and said, you know, we need to make a deterrent on this corporate crime. You know, we have a corporate crime wave, and part of it is stealing the labor of working people. It's also defrauding us, stealing our homes like the banksters did after the Great Recession. And that costs us over $1 trillion a year. Street crime costs us about $15 billion a year, you know, in terms of property that people lose. So the real criminals are in the suites, not the streets. And the problem is they bought the government. And that's why we got to throw the bums out and put some other people in there that represent the people.
Well, not just women. When you look at as a society, you know, we need to also be looking at the increasing discrimination against seniors in the workplace, because I was talking to a gentleman, this was when I was still in the automobile industry, and, you know, he was just recently lost his job, and he said it's going to be almost impossible for me to find a job. He was in his late 50s, but, you know, once you walk in the door and, you know, they see gray hair, they see that you're probably in your 50s or 60s, again, that's like the black person filling out the application. The person that's going to be doing the interview has already made up his mind, I'm not going to hire a black person. The company I just worked with for the last 4 years, of the more than a dozen people that they had hired as receptionists, they only had one person that was hired that was a black. That was a person that the public could see. But when you look at the mechanics that are in the shop, you didn't see any black mechanics that were in the shop. But when you look at what has taken place as far as discrimination in the workplace, is happening against women, is happening against people of color, is happening against seniors. But more specifically, how do you address discrimination that has taken place against many of the millions of seniors in this country? Or should we make provisions where seniors can be on a roster or something where the state can give them some type of support, the government can give them some type of support, that when jobs become available, that they are also part of the candidates list?
Well, yeah, where they have that kind of employment, recruitment, yes, absolutely. But again, there are laws against discrimination based on age and seniors,
right,
specifically.
40
and
over. And
they're not
being
enforced. And you're right, it's rampant. And then it's not just getting the job, it's on the job. You know, I saw that,
right,
at UPS. They were pushing the older people out. Why? Well, sure, you know, if it's a physical job and you're in your 60s, you're going to be a little slower. But you're still producing more value than the company's paying you. And you earned the right to continue. That's what seniority is for. And they come up with trumped up charges to try to get these people fired. The other thing about being, you know, having seniority is your wages go up. You know, you get your seniority raises every year. It's in the contract. So the managers don't want you there. So they're not only discriminating in terms of not hiring, they're discriminating and firing and finding an excuse to fire people. And so this is a case where we need, you know, the law enforcers, you know, the DAs, the attorney generals, the Department of Justice federally, to enforce the damn laws, and also the unions. You know, our unions got to be really active in defending us, because I'll tell you, man, the unions sometimes, you know, the business agents and whatnot, they see a grievance as more work for them, and so they don't always follow through. And the only way we can make them follow through is to be organized as rank-and-file workers, make sure the officers we get or we elect and the business agents they hire are doing their job. So it goes back to the first thing I said about all these forms of discrimination. We got to organize to defend our rights. Nobody's going to defend them for us. And then we got to organize to get the bums out that are not enforcing the laws and get some people in there that will.
Well, that seemed like getting rid of all those folks that are representing those two corporate parties.
That's right.
Howie, I'm looking at for more than 100 years, blacks have been discriminated in employment more than any group of people in society. I think that's a fair statement. How do we deal with racism in employment against blacks and other minorities? I mean, because in particular, obviously I'm black. You've known me for years. But I have seen it firsthand that blacks have been, as you just mentioned a few minutes ago, they're the last hired and they're the first fired. So how do you deal specifically with that group of people, considering that many of them have become relegated almost to second and third class citizens in the society?
Yeah, we have a history of racism that, you know, is founded on slavery and blacks were the slaves. And we've had groups come here that weren't considered white at first. They were discriminated against. You know, Germans and Irish in the early 1800s. And, well, the Irish kept going on for a while. And then the Italians and Eastern Europeans. And even when they did the eugenics nonsense in the early part of the 20th century, they were saying, you know, the Italians and the East Europeans were genetically inferior like black folks. But they sort of worked their way into be accepted as white folks, whereas blacks never did. And, you know, so there's that sort of original badge of racism that we still haven't overcome. So I think besides what we talked about before is, you know, organizing and enforcing anti-discrimination laws and having,
right,
a policy of full employment so everybody can take care of themselves at a decent wage. We've got to educate people on racism. That's happened in the schools. You need to understand the history. And, you know, it started and it's 400 years now since the first enslaved people were dropped off in Virginia, 1619 to 2019. But
Jamestown.
Jamestown. And
that was right down the street from where I was raised at.
Okay. Well, the thing is, slavery ended, but the discrimination continued.
It continued.
The Reconstruction governments that was supposed to provide equal rights, like the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments provide for, were overthrown by violent force by the Ku Klux Klan and the Redeemers. And then it was a fight to the end of the century, but they got segregation across the South in law and across the North in practice. As Malcolm X used to say, the Mason-Dixon line really starts at the Canadian border. And it took until, you know, the 50s and 60s for the civil rights movement to really push back, and they were able to get back on paper equal rights, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Housing Rights Act, and so forth. But, you know, you look at where we're at today, we just went through this great recession where the banks and the whole real estate industry was targeting blacks and Latino and Asian for subprime loans when they were qualified for regular loans, and set them up on these houses that when the crash came they couldn't afford to keep, were underwater, stole the homes back from them. Black America lost half of its wealth during the Obama administration in the aftermath of the Great Recession. So this didn't end with slavery. It goes down right to today. And so, you know, people got to understand that. And you know, we've been talking about black folks, but, you know, there are other minorities today who are discriminated against and exploited, you know, particularly immigrants. They're the ones that are kind of the target right now for terrible reasons, for racist reasons.
Well, you know, when I'm, you know, just looking at what the situation for blacks and how other groups have been, you know, something has been done to offer some type of justice for the injustice that was executed against them. But the U.S. government has made efforts to offer restoration to other groups such as Native Americans, Japanese Americans, European Jews. Yet blacks have not received any reparation as a result of the 400 years that you just mentioned about regarding slavery and discrimination and the violence that has happened since then, much of the lynchings and the abuse and the beatings. And even if you look at some areas of the country where their complete towns were completely burned down, Black Wall Street, what measures do you propose should be offered today as a means of reparation for blacks in the U.S.?
Well, the first thing is Congress should pass H.R. 40, which provides for a commission to study and develop reparation proposals for African Americans.
Are you talking about this Congress?
Yeah, well, whatever Congress. You probably need a new Congress.
It won't be this Congress.
We actually had our first hearing on it,
On
that bill. Conyers put it in decades ago, and Sheila Jackson Lee is now the lead sponsor, and they did get a hearing recently. Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote an article in The Atlantic, got a lot of attention on reparations, testified. So that was a first step, but it's got to pass, and we need that study because, you know, it's not a simple thing. How do you reparations about making things whole, repair? Do you give individual checks to people, or do you fund institutions like HCBUs and economic development banks? You know, if you give individuals,
you know, many of the Indians and tribes in this country, they cut them a check every month. I've seen many tribal Indians, which, you know, I'm glad that they're, you know, receiving something in regards to much of the abuse and atrocities that happened against them. But I've seen tribal members receiving checks ranging between $8,000 and over $20,000 per month. So they get real money. The Japanese Americans, when they were in the internment camps, they received $20 billion, you know, for what had happened during the time that they were in the internment camps. It was actual monies. So when you talk about blacks, how do we talk about deal with the financial aspects of how many blacks have been set back financially? How do we deal with that?
Well, I think that's what we need to study. The problem is if you cut individual checks in a racist society where blacks don't own many businesses, they're going to spend that money and it'll go right back to the people that own the society. So
that's what they say about Indians, right? That's what they say about Indians.
I don't know. I don't know. I think every tribe has its own relationship to the federal government. I mean, I know here they say the Haudenosaunee, which is the better known as the Iroquois Confederacy, get checks. They don't. They don't have their treaty rights.
I'm referring to like Saboba, like Pala, like Pechanga. And, you know, many people say, well, yeah, they get those checks and they just blow it on gambling and drugs and liquor. But I don't really think that is the case. You know, they have an opportunity. I've seen some that have actually used it to, for to better the lives of their families. They have used it to, for further education. I mean, so much of that, as far as people offering what they think is happening with those monies, much of it is not true. It's just based in, just information that they're not really quite aware of what is really happening.
Okay, but what I'm saying is the reason we need this H.R. 40 passed and a commission to study to develop these reparation proposals is that you need to figure out the best way to do it so it does fix the problem. And if you just give checks and the society doesn't change in other ways or the black community doesn't have institutions that will help them develop and advance, then it might not repair the situation. And it needs the voice of African Americans in terms of what they believe they need in the form of reparations. So that's what needs to happen first. But in the meantime, we don't have to wait for this economic bill of rights. That was what Martin Luther King was talking about in his I Have a Dream speech, which wasn't an I Have a Dream speech. That was just added on. Mahalia Jackson said, tell him about the dream, Martin, at the end of his prepared remarks. The prepared remarks focused on the promissory note. He said, we've come here to cash our promissory note. And the federal government tells us the Bank of Justice has insufficient funds, but we don't believe that. And the promissory notes was the Economic Bill of Rights, which King and A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and them picked up from what Franklin Roosevelt had called for in his last two State of the Union addresses. And that was the right to a job, an income above poverty, a home, health care, education, and retirement. And that can be done right now without even having to study anything. And that, I think, is an immediate step that we can take. But I would also say that other groups need reparations. Indian treaty rights have not been respected. Their land rights have not been respected. Like, the nation right next to Syracuse where I live at, the Onondagas, were told when they went to court in their land rights claim that they were too late. They waited too long, but there's good reasons why they waited. I won't go into them. So we need to get back in the courts and get that repaired. And we have to respect those treaty rights because treaties are equal in law to the Constitution. And if we can't uphold our treaty obligations, what about our constitutional rights? And there's another treaty, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. So all those Mexican land grants after, the Mexican War that took half of Mexico from Mexico and brought it to the United States, they also took land of people that was living on it. And it kept going on, for a century afterwards. So there's another place where there needs to be reparations. And then we got 16 U.S. territories that need to be decolonized, starting with Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, which is even more in debt. They need debt relief. We need to remove that Wall Street control board that's controlling Puerto Rico's finances and basically stealing the pension funds of public workers there to pay off Wall Street vulture capitalists. There's a whole lot of reparation or repair that needs to be done with the U.S. territories, and they need to determine for themselves what their relationship is to the United States, whether it's independence or statehood or something else.
I have 5 more minutes, and I'm going to sort of bullet through several of these. What are your concerns regarding members of Congress backing the privatization of Social Security?
Throw those bums out. They're not representing us.
I like that one. What do we need? Do we need to reform Social Security today to address the needs of aging Americans?
Yes. In order for our elders to have a secure retirement, I'm calling for a doubling of Social Security benefits. It's the best anti-poverty program we've had. And, you know, the baby boomers, their wages stagnated, cost of living went up, they don't have savings, so we need to increase Social Security.
Do you support Medicare for all, single-payer health care, or a national health care program? National health care program as in publicly funded, publicly administered, and publicly delivered.
I favor that form, that latter form of single-payer Medicare for all. In other words, a national health service. So the doctors and the hospitals and the clinics are under public control. Locally elected boards.
A national health care program?
Yeah. National health service like the UK has, like Denmark has, like Costa Rica has, like Cuba has.
What are your thoughts regarding a basic income guaranteed?
I'm for a guaranteed minimum income above poverty, and I think the best way to do that is through the tax system rather than, you know, like this proposal that Andrew Yang is putting in the Democratic primaries, give everybody $1,000. You know, the Donald Trump doesn't need $1,000 a month. You know, the billionaires, Warren Buffett doesn't need a check from the government. But people whose income is below the poverty threshold, the tax return goes in, and then they'll get a check to bring them up above the poverty line, and it would go out on a monthly basis.
And last question, what should be done to eliminate the $1.5 trillion student debt crisis?
Well, the federal government owns most of it, so they could wipe it out and just take that cost on itself. And that would be a good thing to do so students can get on with their lives, or former students, you know, marry, buy a house, get on with their careers and lives. We should institute tuition-free public higher education so there's less debt going forward. For those that go to a private school, we should have a federal loan fund run by the federal government. And then people would pay that back as a percentage of their income over 20 years. And then after 20 years, the rest would be forgiven. So if you're borrowing to go to Harvard, if you go to, and that would cost a lot, if you go to Goldman Sachs, you're probably going to pay it all off as a percentage of your income. If you go be a, you know, union organizer, you're probably not going to pay as much of it off. So that, I think, is a progressive way to handle students that go to private schools. Yeah.
I hear the music. I would like for you to just to give your contact information once again before we close shop today. How can people reach you and your campaign, Howie Hawkins for 2020 president? How can they reach you?
Get online and go to howiehawkins.us and use your search engine to find that, and there you'll be able to see everything we're talking about, and you can volunteer and donate there.
And Howie Hawkins will be joining us in the month of October. He will be discussing his international agenda, what he plans to do to make a difference for working people internationally. And once again, I'd like to thank our listeners for joining us on the program today, Socialist Can, 1 hour left. We will return to our regular programming next week. Look forward to having you to join us. Thanks again. Thank you, Howie. Thank you, Ruth Ann. Have a good night, everyone.
Good night.